This Way Out, discover the heart of the global queer community, strong, proud, and resilient.
Hi, this is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of IMRU on KPFK. This is Michael Taylor Gray, your host and executive producer. My fabulous co-producer, Arnella Barbara, is in the house, as well as Irene at the board. And tonight we have a very special show. It's a two-parter. Well, not two parts tonight, but the first part. We have C. Fitz. She's a wonderful documentarian, and she did an amazing job on Jules Catch One. It's an amazing interview about Jules Thais Williams and her dedication in bringing, it was the Club 54 of the West Coast here to Los Angeles called Catch One. She gave opportunities to parts of the community that were not being represented. So, but before we start the show with that wonderful interview, we're going to give a ticket giveaway here because, you know, we come to the table with something to offer every single week. We're going to gift to you. Our listeners, all you have to do is call in 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, option one. You're going to go right to the booth. And now we have a very special gift for you. We are offering a limited number of pairs of tickets to see Brown and Out and Fabulous at Casa 0101 Theater, a powerful celebration of LGBTQ plus Latino stories. These tickets are our gift to you for supporting IMRU and KPFK. If you would like to attend, call us right now at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, option one. Tickets are limited, so call now, and thank you for supporting community-powered radio. And now, for part one of our C. Fitz interview and Jules Catch One. Good evening, and welcome to IMRU. Out loud and out proud on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Some places become famous because of the people who pass through their doors. Others become legendary because of the lives they change. Tonight's story is about one of those places. For more than four decades, Catch One wasn't simply one of Los Angeles's most celebrated nightclubs. It became a refuge, a cultural landmark, a place where Black, LGBTQ+, and other marginalized communities found acceptance at a time when too many doors remained closed. At the heart of that remarkable story is Jules Thais Williams, a visionary entrepreneur, activist, and community leader whose determination transformed a dance club into one of the most important gathering places in LGBTQ+ history. The award-winning documentary Jules Catch One, directed by my guest, C. Fitz, beautifully captures that legacy through rare archival footage, unforgettable music, and the voices of those who experienced it firsthand. Before we welcome C. Fitz, here's a brief listen to the documentary.
Catch offered a place where any and everybody could come. The guys used to talk always about going out and catching one. That meant that they were going to go out on the prowl and try to pick somebody up, and that's how the name Catch One came into being. The Catch was important because at the time that we opened, there was still an abundance of racism.
They tried to burn her out when they tried to buy her out, but Jewel is my hero.
That was the trailer for Jewel's Catch One, now available on digital platforms. Joining me now is the film's director, writer, and producer, C. Fitz. Fitz?
Michael?
Thank you. She said I could call her Fitz. Welcome to IMRU.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Michael.
This is very important, the story that we're telling today.
Yeah, it's a very important history story.
The story behind the legend. Now, for listeners who may be hearing Jules Thais Williams' name for the very first time, who was she and what made her such an extraordinary person?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I did the documentary. There wasn't enough written on her or recorded on her, and I met her. And I was supposed to do a 2 to 3 minute piece on her life because she was getting a community ward. And I said to myself, wow, we have to get this incredible story, this life on film. And she agreed to it. But who she was so many things. She wore so many hats. She was nightclub. Well, first the bar, downstairs bar, that she grew into a nightclub, a huge nightclub. Jules Ketch won, internationally famous, eventually. It took her many years, but boy, she never gives up. And then she had a nonprofit health clinic next door.
And that was during the time of the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
So having those two and you know, connected in that way really provided a refuge for a lot of people.
A lot of people. She saved a lot of lives. She touched a lot of lives. Her club and her patrons that went through the AIDS crisis, and the AIDS funding never really reached the Black LGBTQ community out there, and so she took it upon herself to, you know, turn the parking lot into you know, a soup kitchen and provide health care to the best of her benefit, you know, deliver food, whatever she could. And she rallied the community to do that. She was, you know, a saint in her
community. And that's before social media, cell phones and all that, when you had to really do the footwork.
Yeah, she did the footwork and helped her community actually help her community.
Now, Ketch One has often been called the Studio 54 of the West Coast. My only regret is I told you before the show that I did not get the opportunity to go there. So if I could go back in time, that's the one thing I would change.
Well, hopefully with the documentary, you at least for sprinklings feel like you're in the club the way that we shot it.
Well, you certainly created that experience. But that description about it being the Studio 54 of the West Coast only tells part of the story. Now, what made Ketch One fundamentally different from other famous nightclubs of its era?
Well, it welcomed everybody. And it was also a safe space for LGBTQ+, for anybody. That would walk through those doors, and she kept those doors open despite being shut down by the police, neighbors. Ketch One was burned down, you know, and they never really found out who it was. And then,
well, they chose not to say.
Yeah, exactly. And she couldn't get her building permits. It took her 2 years. You know, she just never gave up. But Ketch One was a home for many.
Well, it particularly was created because there wasn't a space for men of color in particular.
Especially men of color in the LGBTQ community.
Because you couldn't go to West Hollywood. Studio One?
Yep, Studio
One. Yeah, you couldn't get in there if you were Black or brown.
Yep, there's a story in the film about Jewel trying to get in with her friends and, you know, being turned away. It's crazy.
Within our own community.
Right.
Yeah, well, yeah, we have some work to do. Now, the film makes it clear that opening a Black-owned LGBTQ+ welcoming nightclub in Los Angeles during the 70s wasn't simply a business decision. It was an act of courage. Now, we just talked about a little bit about the social climate. What was she facing when she was about to open the doors of that?
Oh, gosh. Well, first she owned the bar downstairs. She bought it for like $17,000-$18,000. And back then, it was filled with a lot of white men that didn't necessarily want her owning it, taking over any of it. It was horrible, actually. And she...
And her being a woman, too.
And her being a woman, not having a lot of money, not obviously having a lot of support, especially on the bar stools in front of her. And she had to serve them. She had to be the bartender at that time. And it was really, really rough. But, you know, she was in it, and she wanted to make it inclusive of the community right outside those doors. And it really wasn't. So she started with the downstairs bar and then eventually grew to the whole building.
Now, was the community that the bar was located in that she bought that building, was it in a community that was predominantly white or predominantly people of color?
People of color, yeah. It was Pico and Norton and... you know, and a lot of paparazzi didn't go out there. That was one of the things people liked about the club, too. Like the celebrities, you know, that paparazzi wouldn't go out there. They didn't care about those neighborhoods.
So those pasty white butts sitting on those bar stools didn't like in a community
right.
that
Yep.
You know, they went in there and they were rude.
Gave her a lot of heck.
She made up for it. Now, one of the things I appreciated most about the documentary is that it doesn't present Jewel as a mythic figure. It presents her as a real woman with remarkable determination. Now, as you spent time with her, what qualities impressed you the most? I see you smiling.
Oh, gosh, yes. She was so humble. You know, for somebody being so large amongst many communities, and not just the nightclub community, but the healthcare community and, you know, even Representative Maxine Waters, some government people, and becoming such a leader, she was so humble even when I met her. And, you know, I said, we have to do a full documentary on you. There's, like, not enough out there. And she's like, okay, you know, and she
was... she a little hesitant? Or?
Hesitant because she's shy. Not
because she didn't want to tell the story.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, she definitely was honored by that, but she's shy. And I didn't expect that at all because, you know, she's tough. She had to be tough in order to put up with the police shutting her down and all that went on, and also have tremendous amount of energy and run circles around me. One of the other things that she taught me, you know, with all this responsibility on her shoulders, every day, different communities, she always found the time to laugh. And it's so important. It is a little bit of medicine, you know, to keep our spirits in that world.
And we need it now.
Yeah, I'm a very serious person, especially when I'm working. And, you know, I don't know. She was always teaching me a lot, including about being, she turned the restaurant down below, the bar, into a vegan restaurant. I'm not a vegan, but so she taught me a lot about that too.
Yeah. Did she have any issue with you not being a person of color during this documentary?
I mean, it never came up between Jewel and I. I think, you know, she knew.
Has anybody else brought it up?
The point is that this needed to be done.
Exactly.
And I was willing to do it. And exactly. I didn't have a plan when I was saying we need to do a documentary on you. Mm-hmm. I just knew as a human and as like a filmmaker, having the skills of a filmmaker, that I could try to do it, right? I didn't have a plan, oh, I'm going to do it by next year or anything like that. It took me 6 years to make, and it was not easy at all.
That's not unusual for documentaries.
It was my second, and the first one took five. Like, I knew, and especially of this caliber, the responsibility of covering 42 years of history and doing it right, and then also the celebrities that are going to roll through it and the music that's going to roll through it. Quite an undertaking, yeah.
Now, the documentary features an extraordinary range of voices, from entertainers and community leaders to longtime patrons. Now, as you were making the film, what did those interviews reveal about Catch One's impact that surprised you?
Their love for the community, for the fans, for the patrons of Catch, and that includes Evelyn Champagne King, Bonnie Pointer, Thea Austin, Thelma Houston, and just how like our LGBTQ community, the patrons of Catch One mainly, stood by them throughout all the years, helped create them in a way, in a sense, you know, and their real love for that and appreciation. That was a wonderful thing to hear.
Now, watching the film, it becomes obvious that Catch One wasn't really about nightlife. It was about belonging. Now, why do you think that sense of belonging resonated so deeply with so many people for so many years?
The way Jewel did it, for sure. But also there was such a deep need, you know, that Jewel was providing. And, you know, everything from not only the nightclub, which became a home for so many, but also jobs. You know, she provided for a lot of jobs building this enormous nightclub. You know, there's so many stories about the patrons and about the people that worked at Catch One. Beautiful stories.
Yeah.
You know, saving lives. And then just witnessing her saving lives, you know, being part of the community, helping deliver meals to the AIDS victims in that community. So it was a real, she created a beautiful community of all walks of life that, you know, were being helped by her, but also some people were helping along with Jewel.
And she did it quietly.
Mm-hmm. Very quietly, yeah. Very stealthy.
Yeah. Now, when people watch this documentary, it's easy to assume someone simply showed up with a camera and recorded an important story. But documentaries like this often take years of trust, research, and persistence before audiences ever see the finished film. Every documentary begins with a question that won't let the filmmaker go. Before there was a script, a production schedule, or a camera crew, there was simply your curiosity. Now, when did you first learn about Jewel Thais Williams and Catch One? And what was it about her story that made you say, this has to be a film?
Yeah. I learned about it because I was trying to do this 2 to 3 minute piece. She was winning a community award. But the questions that, you know, make you want to dig deeper and make you want to actually make an entire documentary. There were so many stories embedded in Jewel's life. The things that she created, the people that she helped, what she even became herself. You know, here she is, this huge, internationally famous nightclub owner, basically. And she goes back to school to become an acupuncturist because her community needed more healthcare, better healthcare. So she builds a nonprofit health clinic right next door. The questions were like, how did she do it? Like, mm-hmm. from an energy standpoint, because she didn't have a lot of money at first at all. She did have a desire to serve, but like such a deep desire. It's like, where do you get that deep desire and what keeps you going? So that was one of the main questions throughout the whole film.
Did she have family around here at all?
Yes, she had Rue, her partner,
yeah,
and Carol, her sister. And yeah, so she, and you know, all the patrons.
Well, yeah,
right?
Her chosen family.
Yeah,
as well.
Her chosen family was huge.
Now, documentary filmmaking often depends on earning someone's trust. And Jewel invited you into very personal chapters of her life. How did the relationship between the two of you develop over the course of making this film?
It was really beautiful. I knew, you know, from my first documentary that it does take time and trust to get at the real story and allow them to be themselves and really tell beyond the nightclub, tell beyond the healthcare center. And we had lunches. We had all different kinds of things. And it was those beautiful times where we would not be shooting. That was so important.
Food helps.
Food does help. Even vegan food.
Talking over food, you know, sharing a meal. Breaking bread, all that. It really does. It gives you a nice connection.
Yeah, and especially for Jewel, too, who, like I said, was a little shy, camera shy, too, you know. She speaks beautifully in the film, but, you know, she is a little humble and shy. And I think those lunches were a real big part of being the filmmaker and creating the film. You know, every lunch we had, I called it the list, and I would make a list of the celebrities that she would mention, like Madonna, you know, that we know that's there. Every lunch, though, she would mention a few more names that had been through the Catch. And I'm like, Jewel, I don't have this on the list.
I knew Madonna had been. That's wonderful. That really speaks volume and how the word got out. The film has an intimacy that suggests people weren't simply answering interview questions. They were sharing memories with someone they trusted. Was creating that level of comfort something you intentionally worked toward with your interview subjects? Because I trust you, and I just met you.
That's really important to me. You know, I want the subjects to feel comfortable, and I want them to tell their truth, their story, their side of it, their perspective, because that's what we're there for. And the way I shoot it and the team, you know, on the other side of the camera also matters. With how you're feeling, so there's not a lot of crazy bright lights at you and you're in the hot seat, which you are in the hot seat, no doubt. But it's really important to me to have pre-conversations and really make sure that they're comfortable. Clips in there and interviews that they're not set anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, you have a really lovely, genuine, authentic, gentle, I don't know, presence, a spirit about you that really is, yeah, you're not, you don't have this big, bold energy coming around you, but I'm sure it's there underneath. No, so I think I'm sure that helps, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I hope it helps because that's what
So you're drawn to each other. Yeah. That's wonderful. Now, one of the things I admired was how seamlessly the archival footage, photographs, music, I love the music, and present day interviews come together. As a filmmaker, how do you decide what belonged in the story and just as importantly, what had to be left out?
That was the hardest part. My goodness. I gave myself 3 months with an editor, and it took well over a year. My first rough cut was 10 and a half hours long, and I was so thrilled with it. What I had to cut out of that 10 and a half great rough cut was hard. You know, there's hardly much about the vegan restaurant, let's say. Yeah. And I interviewed the people that work there.
You're not too upset about. Because you're not vegan.
That's true. I am not vegan. I mean, I was sort of one when I was hanging out with Jewel for many years. Yeah. But, you know, vegan cookies are actually good.
They are awesome.
Yeah, that surprised me a lot. But what I had to drop from the film, I think there's a good smattering of everything, right? I wanted the music to be strong. I wanted those artists to shine. I wanted the celebrity voices in there because I think then the film and its history reaches further, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to give up Jewel's story or the story of like Al Vaughn and Shorty and those stories of
those are the names you love.
Yeah, that worked there, that were her chosen family are so important. And so it was the hardest dance ever.
Now, do you still have all that footage?
I sure do.
Good. Now, was this before documentaries you might see in part one, part two, part three, part four, like on Netflix and all that?
Right before it, kind of. Yeah, I know, because it would make like a good 10-part series, to be
honest. Yeah, because I'm thinking, I'll watch all that.
Even through the decades, you know, you could do. So, yeah, that was really hard.
Netflix, are you listening? We said this last week, too. Netflix, yes, I think that's wonderful. Let's make it happen.
Let's do it.
There's a wonderful rhythm to the documentary. It celebrates joy, community, while never avoiding the harder moments in Jewel's life or in LGBTQ+ history. How did you strike that balance between celebration and honesty? Because we've had a lot of honesty that maybe not as joyful.
Yeah, it was important, and I talked to Jewel about this. You know, she's not perfect, I'm not perfect, nobody's perfect. And, you know, somebody of that caliber and all that she's done, and we have to celebrate it.
Yeah.
You have to show the human side of it, you know, because otherwise it's not going to be inspirational. And showing that she had a problem with drinking even is
what's
in
our flaws that make us human.
Yeah. And the struggles that she had was really important to show to balance the whole Jewel side of the story. And it was really important to me that she allowed me to show the flaws, too.
Well, that, again, is the trust.
Yeah.
So good on you for making that happen.
Thank you.
So Fitz, every documentary has at least one day during production when they wonder whether they're actually going to finish the project.
Oh, boy.
See how I did that with the sentence?
Yeah.
We're actually going to finish the project. Now, what proved to be the biggest creative or logistical challenge in making Jewel's Catch One, the documentary?
There was a time during the 6 years I didn't live in L.A. That was hard.
Were you back in the East Coast?
Yeah. Long story, I'd been robbed and everything else, so I left. But I came back, and actually upon coming back, I was like, on the major has to be finishing this film. I am back. And I wasn't gone very long, you know, maybe 8 months or so. But it was so near and dear to me. I'd already worked so hard at capturing over the years. And then came the 40th anniversary, and I was so psyched. I was back in L.A., and, you know, I was grinding away and going to capture the 40th anniversary of Jewel's Catch One, and so excited. And Jewel was so excited, and so many people also came out. So you could actually invite a lot of the patrons, a lot of the friends, a lot of the chosen family that necessarily a one-on-one wasn't going to do. So that was really important, that 40th anniversary, even though it's just a smattering in the documentary. But one of the harder things, I think, was the music. And I got steered down the wrong path of, you know, music licenses and things like that. So I had to, you know, raise some more money at the end. It was going on Netflix and make sure and to try to keep all the music. And I only lost one song.
Okay. Yeah, because if you post anything on YouTube or anywhere else like that, it's not, you know, the rights for it. Yeah.
Which, you know, We did, and we did it. I had some great people that helped me along the way that you can see in the credits. They're amazing.
You surround yourself with people who are good in their lane.
Yeah.
You know, that's good. Now, was there a moment during the filming while you were editing the documentary when you found yourself unexpectedly emotional, perhaps realizing just how significant Jewel's story truly is?
I think I always believed it was super significant. However, emotional would be my own coming out story. I mean, I was semi out, but we didn't have social back then. And I was in my kitchen and we were at the tail end. I'm like, gosh, if this film goes anywhere, like I'm like way, way out, you know, like not that I cared really, but I'm sort of shy myself and private and everything else.
You're going to get a few calls. Fitz, is there something you want to tell me?
This is like solid now. Like we knew, but well. I mean, look at my hair. It's like, we knew.
It's fabulous.
but as far as emotional goes, making the film, you know, there's a lot of archival. The balls were definitely emotional. And all the people that came out, and you can see it in the tapes, the people that were there, the people that are working hard, the host, you know, all that goes into raising money to help save lives.
And she didn't have to tear down the West Wing and build 90,000 square foot ballroom, right?
That part.
She's tasteful. Now, since the documentary premiered, you've had the opportunity... Let me say that better. Since the documentary premiered, you had the opportunity to watch and experience it together. What's been the most meaningful reaction you've received from viewers, especially those who may never have heard of Catch One before seeing the film, which I can't imagine?
It's twofold. I had Jewel with me during the film festivals, and seeing her get her flowers from the audiences, seeing her get standing ovations because of the life that they just witnessed on the screen, and having her with me and having her go up on stage, not necessarily me or before me or whatever, and get that standing ovation. I have so many great pictures from behind her looking at that audience standing with the ovations, which was beautiful. The other one would be in Houston, Texas. I went to a film festival there and I was just by myself, but they watched the film and I'm a big proponent of finding your heroes in your backyard, right? Your own backyard. And I talked a little bit about that, about why I did Jewel's Catch One and celebrating Jewel, a hero in my own backyard. And they looked at each other and they were like, oh, wow, we need to do that. And then they pointed somebody out in the theater. And that woman was a big hero in their own backyard, very much like Jewel, but for Houston. And they all got just so excited. They can do it with a phone. They can do it in different ways. It doesn't have to be, you know, long and drawn out or anything like that. But celebrate these heroes that are making a difference. So that was pretty awesome.
That's incredible. It's the film's inspiring other communities to do what you've done. Now, one of the things that stayed with me after watching the documentary is that it isn't simply about a nightclub. It's about community. Now, it's about creating a place where people could walk through the front door, exhale, and simply be themselves. Some inhaled, but that's another story altogether.
Yeah, that's a whole other track.
Not Bill Clinton. Now, that mission became even more profound during one of the darkest chapters in our history, our queer history. That's where I'd like to take our conversation next. Wow, and that's the end of part one of our two-part interview with documentary filmmaker C. Fitz and her wonderful award-winning documentary, Jewel's Catch One. Part two of our interview with C. Fitz, well, I'll just call her Fitz because she lets me do that. So part two of our interview with Fitz will air on Monday, October 12th. Tell all your friends. I know that's a little bit of ways from now, but it's important that we put it all together. And now I want to thank earlier we talked about giving away tickets to Brown and Out and Fabulous at Casa 0101 Theater. It's a powerful celebration of LGBTQ+ Latino stories. We're still taking calls if you want to call in, but I want to thank Pam in Baldwin Hills. She's going to take her partner, Karen, to see the show. Good for you, Pam and Karen. And for Marcus, our friend Marcus in Hollywood. So we've got some theater aficionados who are going to enjoy their time there. And I think Arnella Barber, my co-producer, and I think we're going to go too. Yes, I think we shall. Now, back to the interview that you just listened to, part one. And what I appreciate most about Jewel's Catch One is that it reminds us that history isn't something that happens somewhere else. History happens because ordinary people decide they're no longer willing to wait for someone else to make things better. Jewel Thais Williams didn't simply open a nightclub. She opened a door. And for countless people, walking through that door changed the course of their lives. Thank you for preserving that legacy so beautifully.
And thank you for spending time with us on IMRU, C. Fitz. Fitz. My thanks to Fitz, to Mona LFE, and to Arnella Barbara, and to Irene for helping make this program possible. Yes. Coming up next, our queer community calendar, followed by the second half of our hour, the International LGBTQ+ Radio.